Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
On May 6, 1937, Joseph Spa, a German acrobat, finds himself in the main dining room of the airship Hindenburg. Airships are in their heyday, and the Hindenburg is Nazi Germany's most elegant and largest flying craft, their pride and joy. This enormous monument to human engineering, as tall as a 13-story building, will carry Joseph across the Atlantic. He is traveling from Frankfurt, Germany, to New Jersey, USA, in the most luxurious possible way in the 1930s. But something feels wrong. Joseph looks out over the landing site, a large airfield. Below, he sees a sea of people waving their hands to welcome the ship and its passengers. Crew members and reporters prepare for landing. They will be the first to see the flames. On the ground, the airfield manager, Charles Rosendahl, watches in horror as the giant craft catches fire. He sees the falling fireball getting closer and feels the heat from it getting stronger. He inhales its smoke and finds it hard to breathe. A rush of panic shoots through his body. Already at the first flame, he realizes that the fire will cause the ship to explode. He now thinks that this will be the end not only for himself, but for everyone on the airfield. From afar, reporters and expectant family members watch the ship's transformation. In a matter of seconds, the world's largest and most luxurious vessel has been transformed into a 100,000 cubic foot fireball, now slowly falling to the ground. Mayday, a show about disasters and accidents. In this episode, we'll tell you about the Hindenburg airship crash, a disaster that would affect the way we fly forever. The hosts of this episode are Luke Welland and me, Maya Nalani.
The Hindenburg airship is a Zeppelin, a giant hot air balloon consisting of 15 colossal aluminum rings, the size of Ferris wheels. In between are 16 gas balloons. On the outside of the steel skeleton, the Zeppelin is covered by cotton fabric, dipped in a special paint that protects the ship's inside from overheating. The lower part of the interior is used to build what will be the passenger cabins and public areas. The interior is, to this day, perhaps the most luxurious that air travel has ever offered. During the journey, passengers can sleep in their private cabins, walk over to the restaurant and sit at one of the 10 tables, or have a drink in the lounge area on the other side, while looking out over the sea from one of the ship's many open windows. But luxury doesn't always come cheap. Only the most affluent have the chance to cross the Atlantic on this amazing vessel. A ticket costs around 1,200 D-marks, a year's salary for most Germans at the time. Since 1936, The airship Hindenburg has made 17 trips across the Atlantic, 10 to the USA and 7 to Brazil, as well as offering unbeatable comfort with its dining room, promenade deck, and spacious cabins. The Hindenburg has also cut the travel time between Europe and North America in half, compared to the most modern cruise ships of the time. Two lunches, two dinners, and three breakfasts can be enjoyed in the ship's restaurant. Countless drinks are served in the ship's bar, to the tune of a grand piano constructed from lightweight materials, before it's time to go to bed in one of the passenger cabins. Perhaps a last cigarette is lit in the hermetically sealed smoking room before going to bed. Some of the travelers on these trips are journalists. One such journalist is an American named Webb Miller. He will later write a long article about the journey aboard the Hindenburg, describing every part of the ship in detail. Part of the article is about the ship's interior. He writes, 16 large hydrogen balloons filled most of the interior. They contained almost 200,000 cubic meters of hydrogen, 10 times lighter than oxygen and so flammable that a single spark could cause the ship to explode instantly. End quote. So, what creates the Hindenburg's lift is hydrogen, a gas 10 times lighter than oxygen, but extremely flammable if it comes into contact with fire or high heat.
On May 4, 1937, the Hindenburg is 2 days away from its final destination of New Jersey. On deck, acrobat Joseph Spa walks around with his camera, filming the upscale rooms and the Atlantic waves breaking below the ship. In the bar, the German bartender has just learned how to mix a real Manhattan, and the adult passengers taste the nightcap with delight before going to sleep. The routines on board will continue for the next 2 days. In the ship's restaurant, passengers eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner at set times. And in the hours between, passengers are free to do as they please. Some use their time to write letters, while others take the opportunity to chat with their fellow travelers, preferably over a few drinks. Children and adults alike are amazed by the view. Down at sea, they can see huge icebergs. But for acrobat Joseph Spa, the huge icebergs beneath them have more of an ominous connection. They take him back 25 years to when the RMS Titanic hit an iceberg and sank. Joseph Spa reflects, ironically, on how dangerous it would have been to be on a boat instead. At 3 o'clock in the morning, the ship glides over the skyscrapers of Manhattan. It is a magnificent sight. An acrobat Joseph Spa and the other passengers are overwhelmed by the enormous city with its towering skyscrapers. But as the Hindenburg heads for Lakehurst, New Jersey, where the ship will land, Spa sees dark clouds in the sky. He describes the weather as troublesome. It is, after all, difficult to land a vessel as large as a Zeppelin when the wind is blowing. Joseph Spa, who must have been eager to land and see his wife, is informed that the landing will be delayed. The reason is precisely the bad weather conditions. Shortly thereafter, Spa sees a flash of lightning far off in the distance. His anxiety must have been palpable because an officer approaches him and assures him that he has nothing to worry about. The officer tells him that storms are not dangerous for a Zeppelin. We could fly right through it, or in our case, fly around it, the officer says. Joseph Spa accepts the explanation, and the Hindenburg makes a long run around the storm, a maneuver designed to ensure the ship does not suffer an accident, but which delays its arrival time in the United States, a propaganda loss for the Nazi homeland.
An hour later, just after 4 o'clock, the ship has reached its final destination, Lakehurst Airfield in New Jersey. But the bad weather that has now moved in over the airfield worries both the Hindenburg's captain and the manager of Lakehurst Airfield. In a radio message to the Hindenburg, the airfield manager recommends that the captain should wait to land until the weather improves. The captain then takes the Hindenburg out over the New Jersey coast, and by 6 o'clock in the evening, the weather has improved. A few minutes later, airfield management again contacts the Hindenburg and clears the Zeppelin to come in for landing. Just over an hour later, the Hindenburg towers over the spectators at Lakehurst Airfield. The ship, which must land directly into the wind, begins the landing with a wide turn to meet the coming easterly wind and gradually approach the ground.
Joseph Spa talks about the descent in an interview with German television. On the ground, people were waving at us, and I imagined I could see my wife down there among them. I put my camera to my eye to capture the powerful scene. End quote. When the Hindenburg has made its left turn and the captain has slowed down the engines, one of the crew notices that the ship is leaning backwards. To compensate, he releases hydrogen gas from sections 11 to 16, the rear sections of the ship. When that doesn't work, he orders the release of 290 gallons from the water tanks to reduce the ship's rear weight. Meanwhile, wind conditions at Lakehurst Airfield are changing. Now, the winds are suddenly blowing strongly to the southwest. In order to land against the wind, the captain has to turn the ship around again. The Hindenburg is now just above the landing site, and repeating the large turn he just made is out of the question. The captain is worried that the weather conditions will deteriorate further and wants to make a quick landing. He decides to perform a tight S-turn, i.e., to maneuver the ship in an S-shaped turn to quickly bring it around in the right direction. The turn is sharp, and several of the crew and passengers have to hold on tight to avoid falling over. After the S-turn, the captain continues the slow descent towards the runway and turns off the engines. When the engines are shut down, there's an eerie silence, an ominous silence. Just over 150 feet off the ground, he gives the go-ahead to drop the giant landing ropes. As it is the first flight of the year to Lakehurst, the American media are at the airfield to report. Herbert Morrison, a longtime radio journalist, has been asked to describe the Hindenburg's arrival to the American radio audience.
He describes it as a fantastic view. The Hindenburg comes slowly down from the sky, pointing straight at the spectators and the mast where the ship will be moored. He describes the ship almost as a beast. The engines roar and the propellers bite the air and spit it out like a stormy vortex. But it is not just a terrifying beast that Morrison sees in the ship, but beauty and splendor. He describes the Hindenburg as a flying palace. He says, "Occasionally the well-polished surface of the propeller shines in the sunlight. The sun also shines on the eastern side of the observation deck, and its windows sparkle like jewels lying on black velvet." End quote. It's not just the ship that amazes Morrison. The effort on the ground gets almost as much attention. He says, "Now the field, which seemed to be in full swing already when we arrived, has turned into a huge mass of collective action. The landing crew has been directed to their posts. Directives are being passed around and final preparations are being completed. This is the moment we have been waiting for so long." End quote.
Inside the airship, the travelers look out and talk excitedly to each other. But the chatter turns to screams and the anticipation to horror, as a deafening bang thunders through the dining room. Suddenly, the floor sinks beneath the travelers and several fall. Panic starts to spread. Heat rushes through the dining room, a heat that can only mean one thing. On the ground, there's a group of landing crew members who are responsible for the rear of the Hindenburg during the landing. The ship is impressive, and they find themselves staring at the huge body of the ship when one of them suddenly sees something strange. Toward the rear, he sees wave-like movements under the outer fabric of the ship. It is unlike anything he's ever seen before. He immediately suspects that it is hydrogen gas leaking from one of the rear balloons. Then, the inferno begins. What was not allowed to happen, happens. The incredibly sensitive hydrogen gas ignites. Slowly, but surely, flames begin to engulf the ship as smoke fills the sky. On live radio, a distraught Herbert Morrison tries to describe what is happening in the air above him.
Morrison is in the middle of describing the landing when he exclaims that the ship has caught fire. He describes the accident as one of the world's worst disasters. There's genuine panic reflected in his disjointed speech that tries to both describe the disaster and get people on the ground to be careful. He says, "It is burning 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrible accident, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and fire and the hull is colliding with the ground. It doesn't reach the mooring mast." End quote. Morrison is stunned and has difficulty breathing. He does not want to describe the disaster any further, in consideration of listeners who have loved ones on board the ship. Morrison decides to interrupt the broadcast.
In just a few seconds, the mighty Hindenburg has been transformed into a sea of fire, falling to the ground. Inside the ship, heartbreaking screams are heard. The acrobat Joseph Spa, who has been holding his camera to his eyes, hoping to find his wife down on the runway, has lost his balance, and the camera has fallen from his grasp. Now thrown against the plastic glass at an unimaginable speed, he has two options: jump or burn alive. Perhaps it is his background as an acrobat that makes him dare to do the former, to jump. He gets to his feet and manages to throw himself out of the ship, 20 feet off the ground. As he lands, his left leg buckles, and he remains lying there as all hell breaks loose above him.
The passengers are now on a burning Zeppelin, many feet above the ground. They must choose between the fire and a high fall. A mother decides to throw her son out of a window rather than let him burn, and then jumps after him. They both survive the fall. However, the father and daughter of the family cannot get out in time. They meet their end in the falling inferno. Down below, ground staff and spectators are running for their lives. Everything happens so fast that photographers do not even have time to film or photograph the first moments of the explosion. Survivors testify to the enormous heat, with many suffering burns just from being in the vicinity of the massive fire. An elderly man who was part of the ground crew becomes one of those who can't get away from the accident site fast enough. He allegedly stumbled on a railway track in a moment where every second counts, and later died from his burns.
When the colossal fireball, which only seconds before was the world's most luxurious aircraft, hits the ground, Joseph Spa must think it's all over for him. With the last of his strength, he desperately tries to crawl away as the fire and heat get closer. But Joseph sees a large man running towards him. The man, who appears to have caught fire, picks Joseph up and runs with him out of the danger zone, then plunges back into the inferno to save more people from the blaze. But the fire continues to rage, and soon all you can see is a burning aluminum skeleton lying on Lakehurst's manicured lawn.
individual courage will keep the death toll down. On the ground are a group of Marines. Defying their fear, they rush to the burning wreckage. Their courage will save the lives of several passengers. Of the 97 on board, 62 survive. But many of the survivors are seriously injured. 13 of the 36 passengers and 22 of the 61 crew members are killed. Now it's time to find out what went wrong.
Hugo Eckner, the man who runs the Zeppelin Airship Company in Austria, on the other side of the world, receives a phone call. On the other end is a Nazi official who informs Eckner that a car is on its way to take him to the Nazi office in Berlin that very afternoon. A cold chill runs through Eckner's body as he gets into the car, still unaware of the disaster at the airfield outside New Jersey. A few hours later, Hugo Eckner has arrived in the German capital. Inside the Nazi Party office, he is told the news. Just over 24 hours earlier, the Hindenburg has exploded on the eve of its landing in America. Inside the office, the atmosphere is tense. No one trusts anyone, and everyone wants to point the finger at the others. When a Zeppelin, a craft hitherto known for its safety, explodes and kills 35 people, it becomes a propaganda scandal for the Nazi Party, and they demand that a head roll. The blame must fall on someone, because the Nazis know that many people dislike the party, and that the Hindenburg is a symbol of Germany's industrial and technological power. The motive for sabotaging the ship is clear. The whole world could watch as the Nazis were humiliated, as their pride perished in a burning hell. Eckner, who is not impressed by either Hitler or Nazi policy, is worried for another reason. Eckner has always promoted the safety of German airships. He and his colleagues believed they had eliminated the risk of a hydrogen explosion. Now, the disaster could spell the end for his Zeppelins.
Later that day, Eckner and a group of other investigators board a specially chartered boat to take them to the accident site. It will be almost a week before they arrive. Eckner and his assistants spend the first few weeks interviewing survivors on board. Could someone have had a motive to sabotage the ship, to make it explode? But after dozens of interviews and background checks on everyone on board, this theory soon seems more and more unlikely. The crew on board were proud to work in such a prestigious workplace as the Hindenburg, and the passengers were wealthy and influential citizens who seemed to have had no motive to destroy the ship. Moreover, many of them had brought their children with them on the crossing. Now the investigation is shifting its focus to the ground. Could someone have fired a rifle from the ground and caused the Hindenburg to explode? Again, no evidence of this is found. No one has heard any weapon being fired. And even if that had been the case, tests show that one or more shots could hardly have had the catastrophic impact required to make the Hindenburg burst into flames. The investigation turns to looking at natural causes. One of the witnesses describes the waves he saw under the fabric in the rear of the Hindenburg. Other witnesses come forward and describe the same thing. This now leads the investigators, led by Eckner, to believe that gas somehow escaped from one of the internal balloons into the public space. But how?
Just before the Hindenburg was due to land, the wind changed direction. The captain, not wanting to suffer further delays, made a sharp S-turn to bring the Hindenburg into the wind. The stresses of such a turn, according to investigators, may have caused one of the cables holding the ship together to break violently, tearing a hole in one of the gas balloons in the process. The fact that the rear of the ship was heavy Despite the crew releasing hydrogen gas and thousands of gallons of water to make it lighter, also indicates that gas may have escaped from the gas balloon into the public space. But gas does not explode by itself. You need something to ignite it. When Eckner looks at the weather reports from the day, one thing stands out. It wasn't just raining and windy that day, but also thunder and lightning. The Hindenburg was around 200 feet off the ground, in an electrically charged atmosphere. On the ground, the atmosphere was completely different. When the buffers, the ropes that secure the ship to the ground when it lands, are thrown down, something happens inside the ship. The pads are attached to the ship's aluminum hull. The difference in atmospheric conditions may have created a spark. The cause of the accident has thus been found. So there was no saboteur, no lone gunman, no hijacker. The enemy the Nazis want to find turns out to be an invisible and uncompromising one, the forces of nature.
The Zeppelin was the first man-made airborne vehicle, and the giant airships dominated the skies in the early 20th century. But Eckner's report after the Hindenburg disaster marks the end of their glory days. Never again will passenger routes be served by airships. Instead, airplanes will rule the skies. In fact, the airships were already obsolete in 1937. 2 years earlier, the China Clipper, a large American Airways seaplane, crossed the Atlantic faster and safer than the Hindenburg. So although the fate of the Zeppelins was sealed for good on that day in May 1937, they were already doomed. Today, it may seem strange that people would voluntarily get on an airship with several thousand cubic meters of explosive gas above them. But back then, in the 1930s, Zeppelins were the fastest and most exclusive way to cross the Atlantic. And German engineers thought they had designed a safe ship and eliminated the risk of leaks and explosions. But the events of the Hindenburg disaster showed that this was a catastrophic miscalculation. During the investigation, Hugo Eckner stayed with the manager of the airfield in Lakehurst. The two men are said to have become close there. In confidence, Eckner shared his concerns about the future of the airships. He says, "When I saw the images of the burning Hindenburg crashing to the ground, I couldn't help but think, this is the fate of the Zeppelins and the fate of Germany." And the fact is that he couldn't be more right.
This has been Mayday, about the Hindenburg disaster. The hosts of this episode were Luke Welland and me, Maya Nalani. The script was written by Leo Magnusson, sound design by Victor Pearson. Mayday is made by us at the podcast company, Cast.